It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferrer. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, Republicans are hoping to win a majority in the U.S. Senate this fall. USA Today's Paul Singer will join us to highlight some key races.
First, Toyota Motor Corporation has agreed to pay a $1.2 billion settlement in a U.S. Justice Department probe into its handling of safety problems.
Attorney General Eric Holder called the payment the largest criminal penalty imposed on a car company in U.S. history. This comes on the heels of a recall announcement from GM, which just appointed a new safety director. John McElroy is with us. He's host of the webcast Autoline Daily and the television program Autoline This Week. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Why is the Justice Department hitting Toyota so hard on this?
Well, really, it was not so much the defect that they're getting hit with. It was the fact that they hid this, and they hid it for years. They really tried to stonewall the Justice Department. So this $1.2 billion settlement is really as much as punitive charges as it is anything else.
So it's not the crime, it's sort of the cover-up.
It really is.
Can you take us back? This was a September 2009 recall over accelerator issues. Remind us what happened there.
Sure. There were some very visible cases, tragically involving fatalities, where Toyota cars, or Lexus, you know, which is also a brand that Toyota has, would seemingly go out of control, would not be able to brake the car and bring it to a stop. On thorough investigation, it was found that in some cases, the floor mats could jam up under the gas pedal and prevent it from decelerating. They also found that there were some what they called sticky gas pedals, where if you push the gas pedal down, it would not come up. There was definitely a defect in that. There were also allegations that were largely disproved that somehow electronic gremlins in the computer were making these cars run out of control. That's been pretty much debunked. Nonetheless, the fact that Toyota continued to stonewall and not report this is really what got it into trouble.
How much damage did this cause financially, and how many people died or were injured as a result of the real accelerated issues you just talked about?
Well, that's hard to figure out how many fatalities were caused by this defect, i.e., the floor mats getting jammed up under there or the sticky gas pedals. There's also this concept of unintended acceleration. It's been around a long time. Audi faced a big problem on this, which has largely been proved to be driver error. People really think they're pushing down on the brake when, in fact, they're pushing on the accelerator. And it's very difficult to determine which was a driver making a mistake or a defect in the car. It's not impossible to find this out, but I have not seen any breakdown between fatalities caused by the defect or fatalities caused by driver error. Getting back to your question, though, of how much this cost Toyota, it cost a lot. In addition to the $1.2 billion, Toyota's actually had to put out a whole lot more money. They faced a class action lawsuit for people who own Toyotas who said, geez, even if my car was not involved in the recall, because it is a Toyota, it has lost value. That class action lawsuit cost Toyota $1.6 billion. On top of that was the cost of the recall itself, of bringing all these cars in, 10 million of them, if I remember right. And on top of that, of course, there's Toyota had to pay all its lawyers, the cost of that litigation. It had to come up with marketing campaigns. It had to add sales incentives. Some analysts believe this cost Toyota as much as $5 billion.
So is the lesson here, jump on these things early. Don't worry about the PR. Try to tackle that safety issue head on.
That's really it. The message in this is, if you're a corporation with some sort of product defect, come clean, jump on it right away, get it out. I mean, the courts will go a whole lot easier on you. I believe if Toyota had dealt with this in a forthright manner, it still would have cost the company money, but it would not be getting hit by a $1.2 billion fine from the Department of Justice.
From Toyota to General Motors now, more recalls issued yesterday, I think it was, and General Motors appointed a new, in effect, safety czar, a high-level official charged with maintaining safety issues in their cars. What's the latest on General Motors?
Well, Rob, I think everything that we just discussed with Toyota is kind of a dry run for what General Motors is about to go through. It had a safety defect in its ignition switches on a number of different models that over time could lead the ignition switch to turn off if it got jostled or bumped. Just going over a bumpy road could do it, which would turn off the engine, which would disable everything, including preventing the airbags from deploying if the car got in an accident. General Motors knew about this problem well over a decade ago. In fact, GM's own engineers caught this problem fairly early on, came up with a very simple and inexpensive fix, and yet nobody in management would approve this. And now we're going to find out why. Was this someone who was involved in those programs trying to protect their career, or was this just bureaucracy and red tape run amok and nothing could get through the system?
And this could end up being as expensive, maybe even more expensive for GM than the Toyota case.
Easily as expensive as the Toyota case.
And what, looking ahead now, GM was on the road to recovery, it seemed like, after a big slump near bankruptcy, or they went through bankruptcy, am I right?
They did. They absolutely did.
So now what does this mean for GM's recovery?
Well, look, this is going to be expensive. It's going to be very painful. But, you know, we were just talking about Toyota. 3 years ago, Toyota was going through this. Today, its sales and market share are going strong. In fact, when Toyota reports its fiscal earnings at the end of this month, it's likely to report a net profit of $19 billion. Now, General Motors is in not nearly that good a financial shape, but this will not kill the company. It's clearly something it did not want to go through. Here is an American icon that's been trying to gain public perception and credibility with the American public. This is a big setback for it. But again, it's not as if this is going to push the company back into bankruptcy.
Lessons for other car companies watching, I'm sure, very closely watching these cases.
Well, and I've talked to a number of other car companies, Rob, and they all say, we're not saying anything about this because there, but for the grace of God, go we. You never know when something like this is going to pop up. You know, defects are not at all unusual in the automotive industry. Honest to goodness, there's literally a recall every single week. The problem is when these recalls or these defects lead to fatalities, and even worse is when somehow or other the company covered it up.
Is there a lesson here for consumers when people are shopping for a car? Is there anything they can do to protect themselves?
Well, there is. There really is. You know, there's lots of users online reporting about their experience with their car or whatever consumer product it happens to be. And you can, if you're serious about looking into buying a car, whether a new one or a used one, is get online and find some of these groups that are on there sharing their experiences. You might find that one vehicle is better than another. You might be tipped off that if you really do have your heart set on getting one vehicle, you might look out for X, Y, or Z about it.
All right. Thanks a lot for joining us today, John.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
That was John McElroy, host of the webcast Autoline Daily and the television program Autoline This Week. Paul Singer of USA Today joins us now for our weekly look at the latest from Congress. Both houses are off this week, but there's still plenty to talk about. Republicans are hoping to take control of the Senate in this fall's elections, and there's some ethics news coming down the pipeline.
Paul Singer is the Politics and Congress editor at USA Today. Paul, welcome back.
Thanks a lot, Veronica. How are you doing?
Doing okay. Well, Wisconsin is sitting out this fall's election, but there's still a lot happening, a lot at stake in November. Now, Republicans are hoping to retake control, but before we look at the particular races, how confident are they that they'll flip the Senate to GOP control in 2014?
Well, I think they're increasingly confident, in part because they continue to believe that the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, is a very unpopular program, and that they can run a pretty strong campaign saying that Obamacare is bad for you and the Democrats want to keep it. And that has so far proven to be a pretty good message for them. And the Democrats are still trying to figure out a good response. In many cases, the response of the Democrats is to argue that basically, well, we're in favor of it, but not entirely in favor of it. It wasn't entirely our idea. Sure, there's some things we could change, which is just not as powerful a message as it's bad, it wasn't our idea, vote the guys out.
Is there any evidence so far, early evidence, that that line of aligning yourself with or against Obamacare is going to pay off one way or the other?
Well, the first evidence we got, again, evidence is sort of hard to say because this is still several months away, obviously, but the first indication we got was a couple, I guess, last week. I've lost track of my days. In the Florida special election for a House seat that in a district that had voted for Obama but had a Republican member of Congress who passed away, leaving an open seat, and the Republican won that race. Again, very much hammering on this message that Obamacare is bad for you and the Democrats like it. And the Republicans think that's a great signal for them winning that election because it suggests the problems the Democrats are going to have in the fall making this case.
Now, obviously, there's a fair chunk of months between now and November, but looking ahead, do you see a chance of Republicans getting the full 60-vote filibuster-proof majority?
Probably not 60, but there is a pretty good chance they can get to 51, which is all they need to really gum up the works for any of President Obama's proposals. I doubt they could get a veto-proof filibuster, veto-proof margin, but control of the Senate means you control the debate. And all you need is 51. And that, they only need to win, I guess, they need to take 6 seats from the Democrats, and there are more than a dozen in play where they could make up those seats they need.
Well, let's look at some of the races coming up. Which ones are you watching? Which ones are key?
Well, you know, the biggest races, I think, obviously, the ones that the Democrat is considered most endangered would be Arkansas, a guy named Mark Pryor, and Louisiana, Senator Mary Landrieu. Both of them are Democrats running in states that have voted heavily for Republicans in recent years, including last year's 2012 presidential election. Kay Hagan in North Carolina may also be a vulnerable Democrat. And then in the past couple of weeks, there's been some new races that have gotten interesting. We didn't think they were going to be interesting, but they've gotten interesting. For instance, Scott Brown, who you may remember was briefly a senator from Massachusetts, a Republican senator from Massachusetts who had taken Ted Kennedy's seat. He is no longer in the Senate, is a private citizen, and he moved to New Hampshire. And he's now going to run, or he says he's going to run, as a Republican candidate for the Senate in New Hampshire against Democrat Jeanne Shaheen. Even if he doesn't win, that makes another state where there is a high-profile Republican. It's going to attract a lot of attention and cost Democrats money to defend that seat.
And another interesting race, which has gotten, I guess, even more interesting, is Colorado with Cory Gardner and Ken Buck.
Correct. And you know, again, here's where you have, particularly with the entrance of Cory Gardner into this race against Mark Udall, that was a race that Udall was expected to be able to carry pretty easily, well, you know, reasonably easily anyhow. Cory Gardner is seen as a very strong statewide candidate and a good recruit for the Republicans. And again, it makes that race much more interesting and much more competitive. That is another place where Democrats will have to spend money to defend a seat. And there are very few places on the map where they can go and get a seat that Republicans currently hold.
Now, as I understand it, in Colorado, there was a bit of messiness and unpleasantness as Ken Buck was replaced with Cory Gardner. Is that going to have any effect on the race?
No, I kind of doubt it. I mean, there's a lot of internal bruising that goes on in choosing candidates in any party because, obviously, we're hurting the feelings of our friends when we choose ourselves over them. But ultimately, this is going to be a race, I suspect, once again, about some of the issues that have been powerful in Colorado, guns being one of them. Keep in mind that this is a state that held a recall election for several state senators who supported gun control, new gun registration requirements, and they were basically kicked out of office. So it's a state that Democrats have a hard time with sometimes.
Looking at a bigger picture, sort of the emerging identity of the Republican Party, do you have a sense what role the Tea Party might play in that November election?
You know, that's a really interesting question. The Tea Party at the moment is in a bit of a battle with other establishment Republicans. And so where they're likely to have their biggest impact, if they're going to have one at all, is going to be in the primaries in a couple of very red states like Georgia. There is a Republican primary going on there where the competition is really to see who can be the most conservative Republican in the race. You will see them in South Carolina trying to attack Senator Lindsey Graham for not being conservative enough. But at the moment, they don't appear to be winning a bunch of these races. I mean, there was a pretty high-profile race in Texas where the Senator Cornyn, who's been around a long time, well-respected Republican Party, had a Tea Party challenger who amounted to very little in the end. So I think where you might see the Tea Party play in a meaningful way is going to be in some of these primaries, but I'm not sure it'll matter all that much once the candidates are chosen and we go to November.
And with that in mind, do you think it's going to matter much that there doesn't seem to be, at least not at this point, a real solid identity, a cohesiveness in the Republican Party yet?
Well, as long as they stick to the message that Obama and Democrats are bad and Obamacare particularly is bad, that is their cohesiveness. No matter where you stand on gun control or abortion or gay rights or some of the other issues that divide the Republican Party, they're pretty much unified on Obamacare is bad. And as long as they stick to that message, they have that cohesion, that's what they're going to run on.
And before we leave the topic of the November elections, what about Democrats? Any hopes in the Assembly, for instance?
Well, you know, they're not likely to take the House representatives back at this point. They'd have to win, you know, 25 seats from Republicans. I don't think that's going to happen. There's just, again, there's not a wave going on that's pushing in the Democrats' favor in the House representatives. And the way districts have been created over the years, they're pretty safe for both parties. If your party has controlled that seat for a little while, you're pretty much locked in. There's only a handful of seats that are really close enough to swing back and forth across the parties. And at this point, a bunch of Democrats have retired, which is, again, seats that they're probably going to lose or have to fight to keep. So there's not a lot of hope that Democrats are going to win back the House of Representatives.
Now let's move on to another area you've been watching lately, ethics in Congress. Now, you've been reporting on the ethics issue in the House involving our neighbor to the south, Illinois. Can you fill us in on what's happening there?
Yeah, that's my favorite topic. Yeah, there is, we believe, an ethics investigation that it will be announced this week. There are against a congressman named Luis Gutierrez from Chicago. Gutierrez is pretty well known because he is a very high-profile advocate of immigration reform for the House Democrats. We believe that the House Ethics Committee is going to announce that they're looking into allegations that he improperly had a Chicago lobbyist basically on his payroll in his congressional office. That's a story that we wrote at USA Today last summer. We discovered this guy had been paid somewhere in the range of $500,000 over the course of 10 years to advise the congressman while at the same time running a public affairs and lobbying firm in Chicago. We think that's a no-no. We are relatively certain that the Ethics Committee is investigating it because we saw a bunch of legal fees that the congressman was paying out to people who specialize in ethics investigations, lawyers who specialize in ethics investigations. And so we think that's going to be announced sometime in the next couple of days.
Okay, that's interesting. So Gutierrez hasn't been talking about this, but we've been seeing the legal bills mounting. Why is it taking this long to break?
Oh, well, that's the beauty of the way the congressional ethics process works. Things take forever. In this particular case, one of the reasons we think that it is the case is a Gutierrez case is that the thing was delayed. The House Ethics Committee can't actually say anything about any kind of investigation of anybody who's on a ballot in the next 60 days. Well, that meant that they were ready to have this case, to announce this case 60 days ago, but the Illinois primary was Tuesday, yesterday. So they couldn't announce anything for 60 days before it. They had to wait. So we think they're going to announce tomorrow.
Okay. So as soon as the primary's over, the things are
rolling again. Now the
primary's
over. Now they can talk.
Got
exactly.
It. Well, stepping back from that case, you also note that a Congressional Ethics Review Board recently marked its five-year anniversary. What was new about that review panel?
Well, this is the panel that Nancy Pelosi created when she was Speaker, sort of the one of the new reforms of that Congress, was to create a panel that would, independent panel that would sort of vet ethics concerns and forward them to the Ethics Committee for action. And the whole idea was the ethics committee did a lot of stuff that nobody ever saw. It was totally behind closed doors. It was never clear anybody was actually being punished. This board creates transparency, and it creates a way for someone like me to look at their reports and say, hey, there's an ethics investigation that's about to come out, and I can track it back and figure out it's Gutierrez. That is a direct result of this new panel. Now, doesn't necessarily mean that anybody gets punished or any more meaningful punishment, but it does mean that we are able to see that members of Congress are, in fact, being investigated for ethics concerns.
All right. We'll leave it there. Paul, thanks again for joining us.
Absolutely. My pleasure, Veronica. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. That was Paul Singer, politics and Congress editor at USA Today. He joins us each week at this time to bring us up to date on the latest from Congress.
When Blockbuster announced late last year that they'd be closing the rest of their retail stores, the news was met with a range of emotions. Some people were nostalgic. Some celebrated the fact they didn't have to pay their late fees. Most of all, there's some ambivalence. You could almost hear people saying, Blockbuster was still around?
The story of Blockbuster is pretty representative of the video store business in general these days. Stores are closing and people are going online for their movies. But our next guest thinks video stores are worth a closer look. He says these stores aren't just places to pick up movies and maybe a bag of popcorn. They actually changed the way we interacted with movies, which in turn changed American movie culture forever.
Joining us now is Daniel Herbert. He's assistant professor of screen arts and cultures at the University of Michigan. His new book is Videoland, Movie Culture at the American Video Store. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm sure all of us have noticed over the years the rise and then fall of the video store, but you're saying the video store was pivotal in changing our movie culture in this country. How so?
Well, I think, excuse me, I've got a cold today.
It's going around.
Well, primarily, you know, one of the first things it did was disperse movie culture at a kind of local level. So, you know, in 1977, the first Hollywood movies were put on VHS tape. And very rapidly, small entrepreneurs from a wide variety of backgrounds opened up little rental shops all over the place. And, you know, whereas before the movie theater had been the kind of center of movie culture, suddenly, you know, movie culture was around the corner next to the pizza shops, next to the dry cleaners, next to the 7-Elevens. And so it made it much more accessible in terms of a geographic way. I think it has to do with the amount of options that the video store provided, right? So that it wasn't just what was playing on television that night or what was playing at the theater that week, but suddenly you had 200, 300, 2,000 movie options, just around the corner from your house.
Did it kind of democratize film culture? Because in the past, you had to be either in a big city or maybe a college town with a couple good art theaters, and all of a sudden you had access to a lot of stuff that never would have come to your local theater?
That's absolutely true. I think it democratized it in two ways. First, that the people starting these businesses weren't officially part of the movie business, right? So they weren't of Hollywood. These were just everyday folks who were dentists or plumbers, and so suddenly these people, general Americans, were part of Hollywood or the movie business. And then, of course, it did democratize movie consumption, as you say, right? So that, you know, wherever you lived, it might not be the best selection in the world, but you had a variety of movie options that you might not have had otherwise. And certainly, you know, in smaller towns, a variety of movies that weren't ever going to come to your local theater. Sometimes arty films, sometimes lowbrow horror films, but stuff that, you know, you didn't have access to otherwise.
Pre-video rental, the only way to see a movie for the most part, with some home options as exceptions, was to go out to the theater on your own with friends or family. Now there was a new way to make movies a social event. How did that change the meaning of movies for us?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of it in part had to do with the way first you interacted with the clerks, right? These clerks knew the store, knew the stock, knew the movies. And so suddenly you're taking part in a kind of public discussion about what you want to rent, what's good, what have you seen last week. And that discussion isn't just between customers and clerks, but it was happening between customers as well and happening among families as they went out into the store. And you had to figure out what mom wanted and what dad wanted and what the kids wanted. And so there was a kind of new way of bringing a general discussion about taste and movie taste into a public retail space, which in, you know, it wasn't like these places tried to become community centers or cultural centers in any way, but they ended up being de facto little cultural landmarks as a result, right? So that we all have these associations with the video store meaning something to us, not just individually in terms of what we rented, but because of the way we participated in our public lives around movies and with each other.
Yeah, I feel like unlike a lot of other retail type stores where, you know, you could go into one store, another store, no big deal, it really was an engaging experience. It was a special thing to go to some, especially of the local video stores.
Totally. And I think, you know, the analogies are, you know, would be like the very good bookstore, or for people who are into music, the very good record store, or for people who are into comics, the comic store, right? So that these kinds of places of not cultural consumption, but shopping for leisure items, cultural goods in retail spaces produced this kind of emotional and cultural sense of value for a lot of people. And the video store was the way that this happened around movie culture, which was new. I think that, you know, movie theaters didn't generate the same kind of public discussion, public engagement with fellow Americans around movies. You just kind of went to the theater and saw your movie and went home, and then you talked about it at work or at school, but you didn't really participate on the site the same way.
Did it lead us to just consume more movies on an hour-per-hour basis?
That's absolutely true. That the access that they provided wasn't just the number of movies or the variety of movies, but because you could rent it and watch it whenever you chose, movie culture became much more controllable to the lived schedules of everybody's life, right? And everybody has different work schedules, different family obligations. And so because it made movie viewing very flexible, suddenly movie viewing went up. And by, I think it's 1986 or 87, home video was making more money than movie theaters. So it quickly became the primary site of movie culture, at least economically, right? And by the, you know, by the 1990s, more people were renting movies than were going to sporting events or rock concerts or many other kinds of, cultural events.
That's a big revolution in the way we entertain ourselves.
Totally. And it's, you know, I think it is about making the movie, getting it onto either a tape or onto a plastic disc in the form of DVD, makes this thing a commodity, an objective material commodity that then can circulate in this really new way, right? So the film print and celluloid is like, you know, is controlled by the movie studios or by the movie theaters. But making these movies portable and small and able to be circulated through culture in this way makes gives a lot. I guess access is the term, right? Like gave a lot of new forms of access.
Well, and it makes the movies permanent in a way. In the old days, if you saw a movie at a theater, your options were to go back and see it again the next day or wait till its run was over and probably never see it again.
That's right.
Now, if we like a movie, we can keep going back and renting it or maybe even buy it and watch it and analyze it and again and again.
That's right. And that's a good point in terms of like the way it also created a new sense of like film history for people, right? Because the movies didn't just come in and out of theaters or play on television that night and disappear. Movie history was kind of there, visible to anybody who went to the video store. Obviously it's not the entirety of film history, and every video store had a limited selection to a degree, but it gave the sense that these objects being permanent gave a depth of historical access. I lost my train of thought.
That's all right. We can dig a little deeper into some of those issues, but I want to fast forward, as I might have on a VCR back in the old days. To the present, we've got things like Netflix, Amazon, various forms of online distribution, effectively wiping out most video stores. An interesting irony you pointed out in your book: video stores changed the way we think about movies, and that, in a way, paved the way for those online services.
Absolutely. I think because, you know, the video store made movies shoppable, right? They provided a sense that we as individuals could find what we wanted out of this huge selection, right? And that we could match our tastes with the selection available at the store. And if you think about the way movie culture has progressed since the 1980s and 1990s, it has been of increasing personalization. And Netflix provides that even in the form of algorithms that tell you what you might like. So that in some ways, the idea that movies are abundant and that we can all find what we want, video stores did that, and then Netflix just kind of extends that logic, amplifies it, and puts it into your home so that you actually don't have to go out into public to shop for movies. You can shop and consume from your couch or wherever you have your iPad, really.
Video stores introduced me to a concept I didn't know a name for it then, the paradox of choice, where I could stand in a video store and walk around the aisles and browse and just not be able to lock in on anything in a store. Were you ever in that situation, Daniel?
All the time. I mean, that's a huge pleasure. I actually personally loved video stores, and I loved the act of browsing. Even after I worked at a video store in the late 1990s and in the 2000s. But when I was in graduate school at USC during the 2000s, I would regularly walk down the street and just browse at the video store as a way of, like, cleaning my head of all the work I was doing. And so, yeah, it was actually pleasurable for me just to see what was there and to walk around and contemplate. And I think that is actually maybe not just for me personally, but one of the kind of bigger losses of the video store is the ability to not just mentally browse or speculate about what we want to watch, but the fact that we did that in real material space is something I miss. I liked walking around, and I liked looking at the tapes and the discs and thinking about what they might be like. Certainly there were times where you walk out of the video store empty-handed, and that's frustrating. But I think that act of browsing provided its own kind of pleasure. That sometimes that could stand in for the movie. Maybe it was sometimes better than any movie you could have brought home.
We're talking with Daniel Herbert, author of Videoland, about video stores and how they change movie culture. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How did the video store change your movie experience? If you still go to one, what is it that keeps you coming back? Do you have a favorite store, past or present? Do you miss video stores in your community? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on our Central Time Facebook page. We're talking with Daniel Herbert, author of Videoland, about how video rental stores helped change American movie culture and the way we talk about films.
And we want to hear from you on this. Are you nostalgic about the days of the video store? Do you miss going in there with your family, wandering the aisles for an hour, emerging several hours later with a movie? What was that experience like? Or do you like the convenience that we have at our fingertips now with services like Netflix? Let us know your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or email talk@wpr.org.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Samuel on the line in Hebron, Illinois. Samuel, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What's your video store story?
Well, I was just going to say, just talking about browsing for movies in a material space rather than cyberspace, I thought was way more, entertaining and valuable. Because with Netflix, I feel like there's too many choices, or even the internet in general,
Yeah, it's almost too easy, too, it feels like sometimes.
It is. Yeah, I want to earn my movie almost by looking for it and picking it up,
Samuel, thanks a lot for bringing that up. Daniel, we need to earn our movies. We need to go out and hunt and gather them.
That's right. I think that there's a whole, there is a certain strain of video store culture that prioritizes the hunt, right? The search for that, the special thing. And certainly I think with the video stores disappearing, that we're more and more aware of that loss, that those of us who love that kind of sense of the joy of, some people call it hunting, other people could just call it shopping, right? Of finding that special thing that makes you happy. but in material space, as the caller says, we've lost something. And with Netflix, I think, you know, for me personally, I can spend as much time surfing Netflix as I used to spend in the video store and still walk away empty-handed. What you don't have, though, with Netflix is the sense that that was pleasurable, right? Like, I used to be able to walk out of the video store without anything and think, oh, I had a good time. Whereas when I watch look at the Netflix queue for an hour, I think, God, well, I've just wasted an hour.
Samuel, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Daniel, if we're not having these interactions, these discussions about movies at our video store, are they still going on? Are they moving online, do you think?
I do think that there's a lot of venues for that discussion in online chat forums, and even when you think about like things like IMDb or other websites that kind of allow users or internet surfers to add comments about movies, right? And things like I'm not thinking of it, but like websites that allow for people, or blogs, right? Mm-hmm. Like the kind of explosion of movie critical blogs and people like putting up their own movie reviews, DVD reviews. So there is in some ways a new resurgence of discourse, film discourse or discussion online that's actually can be quite intelligent and really sophisticated. And I don't know that I want to make a strong link to the loss of video stores and this growth of online discussion, but it does seem like they go hand in hand.
Did video stores make us, in some ways, a nation of film buffs?
In some ways, right? Like, I think, like, in my book, one of the chapters is about small-town video stores, places which, you know, we don't think of as having, like, quote-unquote high culture, like, high taste, but these places, these small-town video stores, were the movie business for these small towns, right? And so even in places without, like, access to an art house theater, these video stores were really important to creating a sense that movies were valuable, that movies were worth talking about, and that everybody could find their own little niche or their own little taste and get that satisfied at the video store.
And this is not all past tense. You point toward a success story or two. I think it's a Family Video, the chain?
Yeah, they're the kind of amazing industry outlier that they're actually not just succeeding, but they're expanding. And I think at this point they're the largest video chain in the country, largely located in the Midwest, because that's where they started. And they're just... they're doing an amazing thing of expanding video stores. They offer really low rental rates. They give, I think, last I checked anyway, they had free kids rentals. And so they're competing for, you know, in terms of offering very cheap rentals. But their real trick is that they're in the real estate business. So they actually buy up the strip malls where they put in video stores, and then they also lease out other retail locations that are next to the video stores. So it's an interesting business model where they're actually in real estate, and but they do video rental in that real estate.
Huh. Let's go back to our callers. We've got Jess on the line in Milwaukee. Jess, hi.
Hi, how you doing today?
Good.
One of the things I miss, I have a collection at home of DVDs and movies. I used to buy... but I would also have, develop relationships with the people there at your favorite store and, you know, just talk about the different movies or documentaries or whatever it was and exchange information. And it was nice relationship building. Nowadays, you just don't have that. And so when you don't have that exchange, you don't have the dialogue, and you miss out. So I miss out anyway.
Jess, thanks a lot for sharing that, losing that personal connection we can have over our movie rentals, Daniel.
That's right. And, you know, it's interesting because we wouldn't think of, at least at the time, nobody ever really thought of the video clerk as being an important person in our lives, right? Because we interact with them maybe 5 minutes. But we do that every 2 weeks, or we do that every week, and we do that over the course of 5 years. And suddenly that time accumulates, right? And we realize we've spent 5 years interacting with the same person, and we, in retrospect, they did become important, even if we weren't aware of it at the time. And vice versa. Speaking as a former clerk, I miss a lot of the people that I used to serve. I was just thinking about this. Like, from the opposite perspective, is like, God, all these people I used to know in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I have no idea where they are, but I spent a huge chunk of my life talking with them. It's just an interesting shift. And I think the caller's right, that even if we do find a way of having a discussion of about film online or in chat forums, I don't think it lends itself to the same intimacy, or at least perceived intimacy, that we had at the video store, because we were face-to-face, right? We breathed the same air. We could hear the person's voice, and we could see their expressions. And that's a loss, I think.
Jess, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Maureen in Waukesha. Maureen, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. Oh, I love this topic. I'm in my 50s, and I'm an enormous movie buff. And I just wanted to say, this is not a plug for Netflix, but I use Netflix. I've had Netflix for the last 10 years. I don't just use Instant. I rent from them. And the information they have is amazing. You can cross-reference by actor, you know, look up different movies. And I used to have to do that in book form. Mm. And now there's just so much information. And I know for some people it's overwhelming, but I do walk away satisfied when I order DVDs.
All right.
So
thanks.
I just wanted to add that.
Thanks for the call, Maureen. So someone happy with the new way of getting movies, and a lot of people are.
Yeah. No, certainly. I mean, I think I recognized at a certain point that I was getting things on demand more often than going to the video store, and I realized that if I was doing that, then everybody was doing that, because I love the video store. And in terms of what the caller says about kind of information, that's a really good point, because with the internet, it's not just that with Netflix streaming or on-demand providing movies through the internet, but with the rise of IMDb in the 1990s and millennium, suddenly all of that kind of metadata, all of that information about movies was at hand. And so all of that trivia, or all of those ways of kind of figuring out what movies an actor had been in, or what movies a director had made, all of that was searchable on the computer, and that was a big shift too, right? You didn't have to ask the clerk. You didn't have to buy a big, thick movie guide to figure that stuff out. So it wasn't just the digitalization, I guess, of video isn't just about the movies, but also about all the information around movies, and that really did change too.
The metadata, as the NSA would call it. Daniel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you. This has been a lot of fun.
That's Daniel Herbert. He's assistant professor of screen arts and cultures at the University of Michigan. His new book is Videoland, Movie Culture at the American Video Store.